Welcome to Nature Bad's last to Radio Network, RN.FM. And it is August 19th, 2014. And today's show, some items beyond the links is abundant environmental information. And the other reports on 24 indigenous men and women, children that have emerged from their Amazon rainforest home. Weeks after. We also cover a lot of ground with Joseph Zumach and Paul Marcotte, our two guests, both who are living well beyond the mainstream. And, of course, we check in with Forrest Palmer and Lindsay Morrison as they break opium. Our Doomer of the Week this week will be another addition to the show near the end. And, of course, we'll wrap up with a brief climate change update from the good doctor, Guy McPherson. But before we get going, we had some technical issues on the show, audio issues, and, you know, those things happen, obviously, and some of that we can control, but most of it we cannot, and we'd like to apologize for the poor quality, specifically during the interview with the DGR members where we lost connection, and then we came back to them, and, of course, you could hear the Skype noises coming in and out. And so we apologize for that, but there's a few other things that people brought up during the week that we'd like to address, and one of them, Guy, is the song, our intro song.
Yeah, people said they hated the song. What's up with that? They said it's too hard.
Right.
We're fishing that indicates near-term human extinction, and the song is too harsh?
Well, I mean, to be fair, we have the song on SoundCloud, and it's gotten over 800 plays.
Yeah, the song has had many plays, and the first week's episode of Nature Bats Last with PRN has about 1,500 downloads at this point. So apparently some people liked it, or at least they weren't turned off enough that they turned away.
Right, and I think one of the complaints about the song was actually your planet is going to make a comeback, and I think people were missing the point you were trying to make, so why don't you explain what that...
Yeah, so the point is, how does the planet make a living comeback? The living planet make a comeback? Well, it makes a comeback for reasons, either industrial civilization or human beings go away. So, too harsh? The song's too harsh? I need to back up on that a little bit.
And to be clear, the people laughing in the background are our live studio audience, which makes up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 people I think we've tripled it.
Yes, and another one's on the way.
Okay.
So that's jury duty will do for you.
The other thing that came up this week were our selection of people we would interview. And last week we had Deep Green Resistance, and the week prior to that we had Ben Pennings from Generation Alpha, which is a new group. And both these groups are considered pretty radical in nature about their response to the industrial model and taking it down, so to speak. And we caught some flack from some people.
Yeah, and we cut flack from both ends. One saying, what are you having these people on for? Because obviously you don't agree with 100% of their message. And then we had, what do you have these people on for? They're trying to take down industrial civilization. And so we heard a person who and can't understand, and we have people who don't think that thing. And then the other extreme was, anyway, why are you having these crazy whack jobs on? As if we don't fall squarely in that category ourselves.
Right. I don't think that we completely, we're ever going to agree with. I mean, for the most part, Guy and I are on the same page, but we don't agree about everything, do we?
Well, we did up until that remark, and now Mike is no longer with the show. We had a great run. See you, buddy. So the point is, we have guests with whom we don't agree 100%. We're going to cover a lot of topics. This is not the near-term human extinction hour of radio. We're going to cover a lot of different topics. We're going to interview people and who represent groups that get to the root of various matters. So that's what radicalism means.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're going to cover everything from, obviously, the nuclear issue to the economic situation around the world and potential collapse of the economic model that we're currently, the growth model, so to speak. Obviously, near-term human extinction in general, but they all will point towards the direction of the theme of the show, and that is that we are not in a position to solve problems. We are in a predicament. And it's really looking at the world in through a lens that is not always solution-based. And so that's kind of where the show is coming from. Each week we'll have different guests. I mean, we'll have people who are into gardening, and we will have people who are into protesting and marching, and we'll have people who are into reading about it. It's all facets, all walks of life. And if you're complaining about it, that's great, because that means you're listening.
And that you'll have your own show next week. So we look forward to listening to that.
This is harder than it looks. or sounds.
I make it look good only because I have a face that's just perfect for radio.
And I'm really good looking. We are new at this, and we are okay with the feedback, really, even though some nights we don't sleep and we curse you. But that's okay. It's only our third show. It will get better, and there's no pressure on this week's guests, Joseph and Paul. So on with the show. So we are going to start with what we usually start with, and that is the not-so-mainstream news. And because, you know, we hear a lot of, in the echo chamber, the CNNs of the world, the USA Today's, the New York Times, we kind of get the same story over and over and over again. So this week, Guy, what is your not-so-mainstream headline news?
My news piece comes from a piece posted at Medium.com yesterday by Dave Paez. It's titled, Canaries in the Climate Despair Coal Mine. And I include the following paragraphs from this excellent essay. I strongly recommend you go track down the whole thing. It starts with, while we debate what tragic mix of nature and nurture ultimately killed Robin Williams, largely missing from the conversation is any mention of the dark tide of scary shit that's sweeping the globe as a possible motivating factor. Why is it that when someone chooses to end their own life, in nearly every case, the debate is always about what a poor, tortured soul they were and how terrible and sad it was that they just couldn't find the help they needed, and never about how maybe, just maybe, they opted out because the world we live in is going down the shitter at maximum warp, and it's getting harder and harder for many among us to come up with good reasons to stick around and watch this horror show unfold? How can we continue to separate discussion of suicide from a discussion of context? Why does it always become a debate about access to mental health services or about having the courage to reach out and admit that you've fallen into a shadow and are pondering the pros and cons of not being here anymore? How can we continue to live in such a state of denial about what's going on all around us and the impact that these things are having on our state of mind? by all means, let's talk about suicide. Let's talk about what's worth living for in modern-day America. Let's talk about what we accept as normal, right, good, and true. Let's talk about traffic jams, migraines, school shootings, full-spectrum state surveillance, Black Friday shopping stampede, Xanax, reality TV, perpetual debt, treadmills, genetically modified food, chronic exhaustion, sleep deprivation, over-medication, constant distraction, infantile techno-fetishization, hyperstimulation, and the other touchstones of the insane hall of mirrors we've created for ourselves. Let's talk about what hope means on a planet that's warming far more rapidly than scientists predicted just a few short years ago. Let's talk about Arctic amplification, methane clathrate rate destabilization, ocean acidification, and abrupt climate change. Just let's talk about everything we do every day that only makes things worse. Let's talk about the chasm that separates the unfolding horrors manifesting in the natural world from the ongoing parade of grim meat hook absurdities that defines our political world. Let's talk about how everything is falling apart at warp speed while our so-called leaders do nothing. Let's talk about how, as this planet spins out of control, we are being urged to continue putting our faith in the same toxic, dead-end cultural narratives that have delivered us and the rest of the planet into the loving arms of the sixth great extinction. And that's just the opening paragraphs.
Okay, so my good news of the week.
Mr. Happy Talk.
Right, is from The Telegraph. And it's this, the headline is, Second Group of Amazonian Indians Make Contact with Outside World. And it's written by Harriet Alexander. And it's about a group of 24 indigenous men, women, and children who have emerged from the Amazon and from their home weeks after another group fed aggressors in Peru. And this is the classic story that's been going on for, in European eyes, the last 500 years. And the people are generally being pushed from their houses by things that are all about the industrial model, and that is drug lords, oil barons, and anybody that needs any sort of resource in a particular area. And there are only about 100 uncontacted tribes left in the world, 70 or so of which are from the Amazon. And people is moving from the or from Peru into Brazil, frankly, as help, which seems to be a predicament because the particular institution that you need help from is an institution in the image. Just the Brazilian government, I'm sure, is looking at this as, well, these are just the bad apples of industrial civilization. And it's actually not, they're not the bad apples, they're just the consequence of it. And this has been going on, and we are really down to the few groups of people who are left. And this is just another example of taking what we would call every square inch, because in the end, we will need every square inch. And so that's what's happening south of the border and in South America, and we'll continue to have. JR pointed out the industrial model goes away, and that's the way it is, I guess, at this point.
Well, you can't have perpetual growth. So what that means is we're in a zero-sum game at this point. The land, the resources, the materials, they have to come from somewhere. They have to come from somebody. And it's the golden rule. The people with the gold make the rules and crush everybody who gets in the way.
Yeah, and in this particular case, it's a blip on a news feed, probably three or four pages in, and it's maybe it'll make a National Geographic picture with a caption. But that's the way the machine works. So. All right, this week we have two guests, and we'll start with our first guest and do a little talking about the local area that he lives in. And I've been talking specifically with my not-so-mainstream news the last week, 2 weeks, about water issues and resource wars and water diversions. And so we have Joseph Zumach, who is a proudly uncredentialed, we never held a title for own businesses full time. Consequently, he's paid little in taxes, never held a mortgage, has no retirement plan or Social Security. While he was living closest to the mainstream, Joseph was a gay civil rights activist and ran a small-scale landscaping business. As his health was impacted by the stress of mainstream life, Joseph Kay had been working with in creating landscapes, finding new depths of support in healing and plant medicine. Following inner guidance, Joseph looked for a community where he could live outside the mainstream. After an arduous search, he finally came home to a place where he felt he was meant to live in respectful relationship. Sharing his dream with plants and animals and people of this beautiful valley that he lives in on the edge of the greatest wilderness area in our nation, the Gila. Welcome to the show. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Joseph Zumat.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Joseph, can you tell us a little bit about the proposed diversion of this river, the last free-flowing river in the state of New Mexico? Can you tell us a little bit about the diversion, what's planned, and what direction is it headed?
Well, this has been a long process of resource appropriation that started really with, it started with the first settlers, if you want to, but it came from, recently it came from a Senate bill in the 12 or 15 years ago that basically said, make a decision on what you're going to do with this water, or just, you know, don't do anything. And the option that's being pushed forward is that we should take water out of this free-flowing river at a point in a very sensitive and beautiful canyon here, and turn that water towards commercial use, essentially. And the idea is that this hugely expensive infrastructure would be built to do that, and it would serve particularly, especially since the water then becomes capital. Everybody who lives here could afford it, hardly. And let me start. It's called NMAWSA. That's New Mexico Air Settlements Act Board. It's basically a sales pitch for the diversion. And it was set up for having this whole water for the free flowing river. And if you want to see sort of the details, just try nmawsa.org, and you can get a sense of what I'm talking about in terms of its details and what it exactly will involve. We're talking somewhere, the estimates are near, somewhere coming out, somewhere near $500 million for building this thing. And this is going to be taxpayer money. And the irony is a lot of the local conservative Tea Party-esque sort of people are all for this. They're all for the pork barrel of it. They want this thing to happen. It's really a bizarre sort of cross-political thing that has created this really interesting debate or local discussion, if you will, insofar as it is a discussion. Mostly it's people fortifying their positions right now. So, frankly, I'll be honest, I think we need to take this whole issue out of the hands of the local people to some extent, because I think it has to go national and it's got to go international, because we're sitting on what's essentially a global resource here. This corner of New Mexico is a continental megalinkage, and what that means is that all the wildlife that moves from Central and South America into North America has to go through a few portals, a few places along this region that are optimal for these plants or animals in particular to move. And we're talking about a warming world, a world where drastic changes are going to occur. If there's any hope for any species to make it through this time, we need these megalinkages. And this river is critical to that. So this is no longer a question of who gets to use the water. I think the question now is, can we keep the ecosystems intact long enough, at least, services that those ecosystems provide? But mostly we need to know that there's a future for the plants and animals of this region. So I offer a few active on this. If you get involved, I realize this is a national podcast. That's why I'm speaking about this. Conservation, that's called GILAconservation.org. And it's a local conservation group that has spearheaded the efforts to preserve the river and to keep it from being diverted. Another group that does a lot of work with protecting the environment and species in particular that are threatened is Biological Diversity. This group is currently very active, and they're going to be bringing forth suits to protect endangered species in this area, in this valley. And then there's also Southwest New Mexico Audubon. So anybody who's involved in a mainstream environmental regard, any effort you can do to agitate on this and to get your organizations involved in saving this last free-flowing river, please step forward if you have the time and the energy. We really appreciate it, or the money. We want your money. That's what we want. Anyway, any other questions? I think I've blabbed enough.
So it sounds like this is the classic case of there's big money involved that will benefit a relatively few people.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that's going to come at considerable cost for the biological diversity of the area.
They're trying to soft-sell this as the least destructive option, but it's basically a resource grab. They want this water. They want it for purposes that are bigger. And I've heard a few intimations of where the money that we're working against. A lot of land in this valley is owned by the mega mining giant corporation, Freeport Mac, and they've got a stake in it. There's who knows? A lot of it is behind the scenes. And the thing is, the spearhead people in the state government don't want to talk about that. They don't even mention that. They're selling us some fantasy about how all these little farmers in the valley are going to somehow support this multi-million-dollar project. It's bullshit and it's absurd.
Enough sugarcoating, Joseph. Tell us what you really think. So is there a way out? Is there a way of following the conventional channels? Because it sounds like there are a few people who are interested in representing those who have no voice. There are a few people, especially people of power, who are going to represent the fish and the frogs and the endangered plants and animals and ecosystems here. So that sounds like to me a fight that can't be won through conventional channels. Can you comment on that?
It's probably gonna be a question of how much we can slow down the machinery. And I think that's where our greatest hope is. You know, this is sort of the last wave of, you know, like just like with the people coming out of the Amazon, this is the last wave of grab for resources. I mean, you know, it's kind of like where you draw the line, and my sense is that I would rather go in a direction of scoping vision here. So what does it mean to be living in a whole to the local, the regional and continental, and basically we're talking this whole from, you know, the equator to the pole here, landmass that needs to be protected, needs to be left intact. How do you stand up for that? Other measures proposed, setting aside the Gila as the Wild and Scenic River, A number of groups that are working called the Sky Island Alliance. Check that. And basically, the idea is there are people actively working to keep this area in its whole state. Now, these power groups with the money I think basically what is going to have to happen is we're going to have to, that it is about the end of the industrial civilization. I mean, that's the only thing that's going to stop them. But beyond that, I don't know.
So delaying the inevitable is perhaps the only strategy.
At this point.
I think David Brower pointed out, and was echoed by Edward Abbey, that every loss is permanent, every gain is temporary with respect to conservation.
Exactly.
And so if we can just keep gaining or keep staving off the beast as long as possible, then maybe the system will collapse before there's an opportunity to totally
screw. We're delaying, we can start thinking about what our concept of is, of this relationship we have to this place, and start building the kind of institutions, if you will, but I think that's too much of a scary word for me. So basically, you could tell by my bio, I'm a bit of an anarchist.
No.
So, I mean, I didn't go for the credentials, because I didn't believe in the institutions that were handing them out. I didn't, because then you have this thing, like, Gaia hit the limits of what these kind of things, like, you can have the creds, you can have the credentials, what can you do with them?
Right.
You know, that's the other thing. But in this sense, I see it as being small-scale work in terms of envisioning a kind of synergistic relationship with our environment that is heartfelt and personally responsible and comes out of a whole different sensibility. In other words, we don't live in a world of resources. We live in a living world. Our atmosphere is living tissue. If we dump carbon into it, it's like taking and dumping something into your blood that is overwhelming your system's ability to function. All this stuff is alive. The river is alive. It's as vital to the circulation, the whole energy of the system. Without a living system, you have death. With death, you know, I don't really believe that the Earth is out to get us, because I think it's more like, at this point in history, we're facing the consequences of behaviors that have gone on too long, and we have to stop. And we have to imagine our lives. If there is a future for the human race, which is a big assumption, obviously, if we're looking at near-term human extinction, it would be one of synergy and respectful relationship in the environment. And so I appreciate the time I've had to expound on these ideas here. But, you know,
Well, I have another question. There's been a diversion proposed, as nearly I can tell, going back to the early part of the last century on this river.
Exactly. It goes way back.
1907 or 1912.
Probably with the formation of the Bureau of Reclamation. They were already making plans, because you can look at maps, older maps of the area, and the area of the canyon was set aside as a reserve holding for a water development. You can actually look on the map, and it'll be demarcated as that. So this goes quite a ways. But the recent cycle of this has been... So there's a way in which probably there's not much we can use them to slow down the process, maybe, but they're actually coming from the wrong perspective.
Right, right. And you mentioned being an anarchist, it's been delayed for a long time. I can imagine a lot of people would say, well, it hasn't happened yet. I mean, it's been proposed for a long time, and there's a few people out there staving it off, and so I don't really need to get involved. How do you respond to that?
Well, we are at a crisis point with the issue. And this is the year they're going to make a decision on the proposals that are being put forth. So if anybody wants to put in time and energy now, it'd be to the greatest advantage.
You mentioned you're an anarchist, and a lot of people, I think, don't know what that means. Can you tell us what it means to you?
Well, it's not quite antichrist, but almost. You know, there's a fear.
And there goes our four remaining listeners.
There's a fear that anything that bucks authority is bad. And, you know, I went to parochial schools, and let me tell you, I knew what it was like to buck authority, but and what the consequences were. At this point in my life, I've just come to this realization that there's a way to be responsible for yourself and who you are and your choices in the world that transcends authority. And when you become your own authority in terms of your basic life choices, your needs, and how you meet them, and you gain a certain level of strength and authenticity from that, that I don't think you can gain any other way. And living in a community where there's a level of respect for that is absolutely crucial. There aren't many communities out there in this world nowadays that allow for that. And there's nothing that's perfect, mind you, but I think it's worth looking to form or setting standards for community that are high in regards to autonomy and respect for individuals' rights to choose their way of living in the world that, that resonates with their own heart, their own sense of what's best for them and their relationship to everything around them, the people, the plants, the animals, and how we share this dream of living.
That's awesome. You mentioned responsibility, and that's a perfect lead-in to our next guest. So, Mike, if you can introduce Paul, that would be awesome.
Yeah, we're going to keep Joseph around. We're going to switch things up here slightly and build off some of the topics that Joseph brought up. And we're going to bring in Paul Marcotte. And he has lived a life of adventure going back to the 1970s, having twice traveled around the world in both directions. He has been exposed to many ideas and met numerous interesting people along his journey. On a visit to Australia in 2005, where he lived for many years, a friend gave him a book to read. The book was called The Weathermakers by Tim Flannery. And it was a book about climate change, and it would forever change his life. He proceeded to read everything he could on the subject, which would lead to the topic of fossil fuel depletion and eventual collapse of industrial civilization and, of course, near-term human extinction. In spite of this dire news, he still considers himself a happy individual. That's a miracle. And spends his days house and pet sitting from place to place and enjoying each precious moment that life offers along the way. He writes a blog called The Thoughtful Wanderer 4 times a month so that his 4 sisters and others can keep track of his meandering lifestyle. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Paul Marcotte.
Thank you, Guy, and thank you, Mike, for the opportunity of being here, and thank you to the studio audience, the live studio audience overlooking the Gila Valley here. It's a wonderful place, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, I think we'll start off, Paul, with because the 4 of us sitting here, and including every member of our studio audience, has really chosen what I consider to be a different and unique path, even amongst all of us, living outside or on the peripheral of mainstream society. So maybe just tell us a little more. You kind of got a little bit in your bio about what you do and how you live, but maybe give a little more detail in why that makes you, quote unquote, happy.
Well, I guess going back to what you said in the bio there, I mean, this really, I have had an adventurous life. And back in 2005, as you mentioned, I read this book by Tim Flannery. And up to that point, I sort of, you know, was a person that sort of knew a little bit about climate change, read it here and there. And then reading that book, it really did, it caused me to just open the floodgates and start reading everything I could about climate change. Excuse me, which led me to energy depletion and all the other topics that go along with that.
The rabbit hole.
The rabbit hole. And so this progression went on over years, and eventually I came across Guy, probably in 2010, I think. And up to that point, and here I come across this website, and we're talking about near-term human extinction, which was a tough pill to swallow for most people, I would have to say. Right. However, by the time I'd come to Nature Bats Last, I had been through all of this education up to that point, and it seemed to make perfect sense to me that this is where we're heading. So
emotionally, what was your journey up to meeting Guy?
Well, I suppose I went through a very, I'd say a fairly dark patch, probably 2006 and 2007. I was, you know, really bearing down and reading all this stuff and wondering why not everybody else in the world isn't seeing what I could see and waking up and going, you know, this is a dire situation we're in.
And you, in a sense, at that point, you became a nomad.
Well, I did, and I guess, and I suppose the part of the equation that caused me to, like Guy, walk away was the whole thing to do with, well, primarily the energy depletion thing. And so when we got to $147 a barrel of oil, I think that was in 2008, and I'm living in a city in Vancouver, Canada, and thinking cities are about the last place you want to be when this whole thing collapses. So as much as I was doing a work that I love to do, I thought I need to leave this situation sooner rather than later. Now, obviously, things haven't collapsed yet to the extent that we thought that they would back then. But so I went. I was living on a sailboat then. I sold my sailboat, and I have been doing house sitting and pet sitting for many years, and I've been doing it full time now for about three. And I absolutely love what I do. I don't get paid for what I do. But I get to spend time, precious time, with wonderful people and nice pets. And so I'm a happy guy, right. In spite of the fact that I know that it's all going away. And I guess the good thing about accepting the fact that near-term human extinction is just around the corner is that if you accept that, then it gives you the opportunity then to really appreciate every precious moment that you have,
right.
You know, yeah. I'm getting emotional about it right now, but it's really puts the focus on the moment instead of thinking about all these long-term plans that you might have. So,
this is Nature Bats Last on PRN. We're talking to Paul Marcotte and Joseph Zumach and discussing living outside of the mainstream or on the peripheral of the mainstream. And I know we had a conversation earlier, Paul, about separating the emotional brain with the factual side of your thought. Maybe you could talk a bit about that and how you came to, I guess, some sort of acceptance.
Well, I think that is the key, and I think that's where a lot of people get tripped up. You know, if we've got these two brains, we've got this emotional side, which I've just displayed a little bit of, and we've got the rational side. And so if you just say, I'm going to read the climate chaos summary and update on Guy's website, and you just look at the facts and try to keep the emotions out of it, it's virtually impossible to come to any other conclusion than what Guy has come to, because these are all just facts that are out there. Unfortunately, for most people, the emotions come into it because for who knows how many reasons, kids, grandkids, job, futures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Plans
and dreams and hopes of the future. And so when you look at that from an emotional side, it's easy to turn away and say, it's too hard, I don't want to look at it, so I'm just going to pretend that it's not there. But if you just take some time, go through it rationally, and then understand what the situation is, and then come to acceptance, hopefully at some point, then it makes life very simple going forward, because there's a whole bunch of things that we all get worked up about in our day-to-day lives that really are pretty irrelevant now.
Right.
And so you can just kind of clean the slate. It makes life very simple, and it can be very happy because, like I said, you can just it's like squeezing the juice out of every moment.
I think Daniel Quinn said in Ishmael that, you know, there's not one way to live. And at this half of the interview is two guys who have been, for the most part, for the last few years, pretty nomadic. And Guy and Joseph have taken a different approach. And maybe you guys could talk a little bit about what you've done and the choices you've made.
Yeah, Joseph and I have chosen a place, and we think it's a beautiful place. And there are people who live here who have a lot of money, and they choose to live here when they could actually choose to live anywhere they wanted. There are people here who choose voluntary poverty and choose to live here when they could live in that way just about anywhere they wanted. So this is a very special place. Joseph, I want you to tell us in general terms what's so special about the place, why you choose to stay here instead of taking a nomadic route. What is it about this place that makes you want to stay and has had you here
for the last, what, decade or so?
Yeah, at least. Well, it's all about relationship. And to start with, it's my relationship to the plants. And you don't store an encyclopedic knowledge of a regional plant biome and just walk away from that glibly. And when you use those plants in your day-to-day life in ways that are important to supporting your health and supporting other people and supporting yourself even materially, it becomes, it ties you to a place, because plants are very much tied to places, and that's the way you am. The other side of it is, when I heard you talking before, when you start to unfold relationships with people that have this quality of giving you this space, the people in this room, part of our studio audience here, and the people I know through the community I know here, can hear things like near-term human extinction and stuff. And there's an authenticity there that doesn't bat an eye at it. Everybody says, well, I had another word for it, but yeah. Whether it's because you have your Buddhist practice shows you that all life is impermanence or whatever, everybody here is grounded in some way. And having relationships like that, that are grounded in that way, I couldn't go back to the world of mainstream life, and my health, my sanity wouldn't hold up to it.
Right.
It's hard for me to go through an airport, frankly.
Sure, sure.
Of course, it's hard for any of us to go through an airport unless that's the only action we get, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Like total sexual assault, people. So you mentioned resources and you mentioned relations a couple of times, and I frequently point out that by viewing the world as a series of resources, we disconnect ourselves from our relations. In fact, the relationships are what's important.
The point is, that's why I said it's about the relationship. Those plants aren't really a resource. And in fact, I feel a little risk in mentioning that. You know, I depend on these plants for healing and stuff. A lot of people want to go, oh, wow, I want to find out what it is. Let's come make it into a business and we'll sell 1,000.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and there are people out there that will do that.
Right. And then it's a resource. It's not a relationship.
It's not a relationship. And I guess, you know, there's no way I know of to sell that. And that's fine. Everything I do comes out of relationship to some extent. I don't think there's any other way to live, frankly. Actually, what I'm trying to say is this is about responsibility on a basic fundamental level, what it means to be a human being and how we relate to the world around us is this is what is up for debate right now. This is what this whole crisis point of the end of industrial civilization is about. We've lost track of our core responsibility for how we relate to our environment, to each other. We get sidetracked into these ideas of economic gain or, you know, all the various, you know, my sense is as the life of the mainstream is very fear-based, and it's very much about having to do things that you don't really want to do because basically there's no other way you can keep paying the mortgage or, you know, all these different aspects of life are taken for granted without really questioning, and we don't seem to be able to pull back enough to say, well, where are the other options? Why do I feel compelled to do this? I from the get-go, I had a hard time with the way the economy worked, and my sense was that they're going to pay you for things that they can make money off of or that there's a profit in, and so if you participate in the economy, the more money you turn over through your hands, the more money you have to have. That means the more you're at the behest of somebody else who controls that money. This learning curve for me started in my teens, and I started wondering whether I wanted to live like that. And I started to question fairly early on, which is, I think, whatever, you know, it was my own personal grace, if you will, though it's not necessarily easy to do that. But when you've questioned at that level, like, I can't think of anything more meaningless than spending my life earning money to pay a mortgage. I mean, it's like, God. I mean, but I lucked into a situation where I live in the land trust, which is a whole different reality. And it was somewhat luck, but it was also some sticking it out and saying, okay, I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know how I'm going to find it, but I'm going to keep trying. When I said arduous search, I mean arduous search.
Right, right. Yeah.
No aspect of living outside the mainstream is easy.
No, we take for granted too much in the mainstream.
Right, right. Absolutely. And Paul, I want you to comment on that as well, that this living outside of the mainstream and what kind of freedom that gives you. Joseph talked about freedom from a mortgage, about freedom from the monetary system to a great extent. And I know that you probably aren't making $1 million a year doing your house sitting, unless you know a lot richer people you're pet sitting for than I do. So can you talk about that a little bit from your perspective?
Yeah, I guess it is difficult in some respects because everybody else is in the mainstream. So, you know, you're probably looked at differently from some of the people that have known you for a long time, and all of a sudden they think, you know, and you've gone through the same thing, I guess, because, you know, he's gone down some other rabbit hole and what's he on about now. But I guess the advantage for me is that, you know, each day I wake up and today I get to spend how I choose to spend it. And that's a very precious thing. And the opposite of that is, you know, going into a job that you hate, which is what, you know, there are a whole bunch of people out there. They work for a living and they're putting in their time and they hate their work, but they keep doing it because the system says if you just do this for 4 decades, you're going to get this nice big fat pension check at the end, and life's going to be wonderful and you can go traveling and everything else. And that's all just an illusion, I would say. And the way things are going right now, I would suggest that most people that are expecting those pension checks to come, that they're going to be sorely disappointed in the not too distant future. So for me, it's easier to just be outside of all of that and spend the time as I do. And I made $1 million last year house sitting, but not this year. Yeah. This year's been a bit slim. I actually had to sleep at the Tucson airport.
Yeah. Nice airport.
It's a nice airport. Yeah. But I mean, I guess, you know, I've done over 40 different things throughout my life to earn an income, and I've never ever gone down that career path. So I suppose I've come to where I'm at right now, honestly, because I never really fit into the, you know, pigeonhole down this track. So I just enjoy the fact that I'm outside the mainstream. And if I wouldn't have been outside the mainstream and following this, I wouldn't have met everybody that's in this room. And that's worth it just in its own right. So there you go.
Well, thanks both to Joseph Sumach and Paul Marcotte for the excellent interview this evening. Mike, what's next?
Well, in a culture full of hope and forms of technology, wishful thinking, a great awakening by the industrial power structure, meaning, quite frankly, ourselves, and what Derek Jensen calls the culture of make-believe, some important voices are speaking truth to power, as we've just heard tonight. Each week we'll have a brief opinion piece, and in this segment, which is called Breaking Hopium, we hear from radical perspectives that cut to the root of an issue and expose some truth that has widely been hidden, ignored, or filed under the oblivious for the general populace. This week, we have our two contributors back, Lindsay Morrison, who expresses what it feels like to be in a mass extinction, and we'll conclude with Forrest Palmer, who discusses the events taking place in Ferguson, Missouri. This is Breaking Hopium.
This Breaking Hopium moment is about what it's like to be one of the last individuals of a culture in rapid decline during a mass extinction event. It's like we're neglected children watching the house we live in fall apart, peering through the broken railing banisters on the stairway to oblivion, and the parents are just downstairs partying continuously like bikers on meth. The cupboards are going bare. They've puked beer into all the fish tanks. First the cat disappeared, then the dog, and things aren't looking too good for the hamster. The caseworker keeps calling and leaving messages on the machine. There's a hole in the roof where the moonlight casts shadows on their grotesque, smiling faces, and the music is so loud I can't even hear myself crying myself to sleep. That's all I have for this week. Thank you.
On August 9th in Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown was shot and killed by a two-legged swine, better known as a police officer. In the grand scheme of things, this is just one death in millions that happen every day for too many reasons to list here, and all equally tragic. As we have seen mass protests in Ferguson in response to this murder, the state is using all types of hard and soft power to ultimately return things back to normal. But here's the thing. What is this return to normal life? What is normalcy? Well, in general terms, the normalcy as determined by this culture is one of driving to work every day, working in some useless task to continue the parasitic relationship of the global north to that of the global south, using inordinate and unsustainable amounts of non-renewable and environmentally destructive resources to do all these things, and exist under the delusion that this can continue into infinity or when Jesus comes back. Pick your poison. Even though the black underclass that's primarily protesting this murder doesn't have the access to resources as a normal white citizen here in America, the energy usage and the lifestyle provided to this underclass is still light years away from that which is allowed in the global south. Yet, what will the people do when there is no alternative existence? Currently, most still have choices, which are to continue to protest or go back to their homes and regular lifestyles. But at some point, relatively soon, there will be no return to a normalcy that was built on an abnormal set of circumstances. What will these people protesting now do when the life they have known is no more? This is the question that has yet to be addressed by the protesters because the foundation of their protest is based upon this incident as part of a larger problem. But it's still not seen in terms of an overarching issue with the state, its ability to sustain its power, and the exercising of said power. And to go even further, what will the state's response be once people of all hues are in the street because there isn't enough resource available to not only sustain Western civilization, but to sustain life itself? Will the state be providing food, water, and shelter to the masses, or will it be a bullet to the back of the skull, a la Michael Brown? And how many people will see this as a proper form of a mercy killing for useless people until they are the ones on their knees about to be sent into an eternal sleep? All these are the questions that people better start asking themselves as they see incidents like this increase in the immediate future. So I suggest everyone in this country, especially in the hollow middle-class white America, take a good, long, and hard look at what is being done in Ferguson, Missouri, because soon enough, those tanks will be rolling down your street. And all it will take to align your needs to survive with these black people in the inner city is a few days of semi-trucks not coming into your local grocery stores to stock the shelves. Then it will finally dawn on folks that the foundation of everyday white privilege is much more precarious than most had ever imagined.
Thank you very much to Lindsay Morrison and Forrest Palmer for those moments of breaking hopium. This week on the Doomer of the Week, consistent with our theme for the week, accepting near-term human extinction doesn't necessarily mean spending your life mired in despair. That's the topic that comes from the Panic Room on Facebook from a comment yesterday from Chevio Lone Eagle. People commonly think learning of NTHE brings despair, and while it can do that, I find it brings closure and an odd sense of peace. I've been fighting against the injustices I am seeing all around me for years. The federal government, its endless wars, its spying, its laws, the horrible things people do to each other, and many other things that are sick. I now do not worry about those things that once distressed me so much. Instead, I see what is coming, and it cannot be reversed. I do not hate humanity for it, as I see it's not something humanity had the consciousness to prevent. We few who do get front row seats to the cataclysm, and accepting it is so trucking hard at times. Speaking of doomers, Mike, what's the latest word from Louis C.K.?
No word, guy. It's been 11 days since I contacted his booking agent, and shockingly, we've not heard anything from the Louis C.K. front. So, all right, finally, we would like to close out most of our shows with Guy's climate summary and update, which you can find on his blog every day of the week. But there's some new things once in a while, and when it's breaking, you can find it here on Nature Bats Last. Guy?
Thanks, Mike. There's recent news about the loss of the Arctic sea ice that reduces the temperature gradient between the poles and the equator, thus causing the jet stream to slow and meander. This phenomenon is particularly well described by the work of Professor Jennifer Francis. The so-called polar vortex became widely reported in the United States in 2013 and really received the attention of the academic community when the 2013-2014 drought threatened crop production in California, and that's still going on.
Also called Rossby waves, these atmospheric events are on the rise, as reported in the August 11th, 2014 edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It seems the Referee Journal literature is catching up with Professor Francis, who has been much disparaged for her excellent but terrifying work.
So did they just change the name of Polar Vortex?
Yes, it's interesting. It was a meandering jet stream, then it was a polar vortex, now it's a Rossby wave. And as soon as the mainstream starts to catch up with it, we'll change it again. That's what scientists do, to try to make themselves separate from the rest of society, you know. We come up with our own terminology.
Look at the big brain on guy.
Okay, I have a comment from the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Perfect. Facebook. This is posted by Tim Lemon, who adds at the end of this, this is about what I expect from attempts to solve technology's problems with technology itself. This post he put up is from the Washington Post from yesterday, and it's titled Emerging Solar Plants Scorch Birds in Midair. Workers at a state-of-the-art solar plant in the Mojave Desert have a name for birds that fly through the plant's concentrated sun rays, streamers, for the smoke plume that comes from the birds that ignite in midair. Federal wildlife investigators who visited the Bright Source energy plant last year watched as birds burned and fell, reporting an average of one streamer every 2 minutes. Looks like even using civilization to solve predicaments created by civilization isn't such a great idea.
Clearly.
So that brings us to the close of another episode of Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM.
Okay, so make sure you like us on Facebook page, Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and you can join our group at Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM on Facebook as well. Again, we would appreciate some questions so we can answer them on the air. And, of course, if you're finding yourself in need of support, you can always join the Near-Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook and join the conversation. There are plenty of people there who are going through something similar that you may be able to relate to. We'll see you next Tuesday evening. If you miss us, make sure you find us in the archives at PRN.FM and rate us on Facebook. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, Guy...
Nature Bats Last. Bring it on. Thanks to Efferson for the theme song.
I know.